Two holy men in 2 years. Are they connected by something other than friendship? A math teacher vanishes into thin air. Something just doesn't add up. A child disappears while on a picnic with her family. Did she wander away, or was she kidnapped? Maybe it's neither, or maybe it's both. A car crash that leaves people questioning what exactly happened. A tale of late-life romance in the age of the internet. But do you ever really know who you meet online? A family disappears days before Christmas. A discovery nearly 6 months later leaves a few questions unanswered. Welcome back to Never to Be Seen Again. Hey everyone, welcome back for another week of disappearances. For the new listeners, I am your host Laura, and this is the podcast Never to Be Seen Again. Last week, we talked about crazy West Virginia with episode 26, and I want to apologize to anyone who actually noticed that I initially mislabeled last week's episode as episode 27. I lost track apparently, but I have since fixed it, so if you didn't catch the mistake then, we'll pretend that it didn't happen. This week is not as crazy as last week. We're going rural this week as we talk about disappearances in Montana. There weren't a lot of cases to choose from, but I think I selected a good group. I think I ended up with 7 cases, but they are all pretty short, so today's episode should be pretty clear-cut. So let's talk about the stats. The population of Montana as of 2019 is reported as 1.069 million. 49.7% of that population is female and 50.3% is male. Now, there are only 20 cases listed on the DOE Network for Montana. 12 of those 20 are female and the remaining 8, of course, are male. This is the first time I've actually seen less cases on NamUs than on the Charlie Project. NamUs has 85 listed cases for Montana, with 49 males and 36 females. The Charlie Project has 91 total listed missing cases. That number is comprised of 35 females and 56 males. It appears, looking at the Charlie Project and NamUs, that the males take the lead in the missing in Montana, but they also take a minor lead in the population as well. So let's get into the cases I have for today. And as usual, all of these cases can be found on the Charlie Project. So we're really going to start down a rabbit hole with this first case. This is case number 4026 DMMT in the DOE Network and case number MP18607 in NamUs. This is the disappearance of James Otis Anderson. James is a Caucasian male with gray hair and brown eyes. He was born on March 21st of 1928. And he was 54 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 92 now. He stood about 5'9" and 190 pounds. James goes by Jim, and Jim has a previously fractured jaw and dislocated hip. He also wore glasses, but he did not have them with him when he disappeared. So Jim was last seen on June 13th of 1982. That day, he was seen driving east on Highway 12 in Townsend, Montana, towards White Sulphur Springs. This last sighting of him was at around 8 a.m. Now, there is something you should probably know about Jim. You see, he was an Episcopal priest. On the day of his disappearance, his church, St. John's Episcopal Church, has a scheduled service. And when Jim didn't show up for that service, everyone knew something was wrong, and before long, he was reported missing. So when they look into Jim's disappearance, they look at his residence. They didn't find anything really out of the ordinary, though. The place was in order, and there was no indication that Jim had planned to leave for an extended period of time. The sermon that Jim was going to deliver at the service that day was laid out on his desk. Jim's razor and his toothbrush were still in the bathroom, which is an indication for police that Jim wasn't staying away anywhere overnight. There were some things that were not in the house, though. Jim's address book was gone, as well as a treasured Afghan and a pistol. Those items have still never been located. Police did monitor Jim's credit cards, bank accounts, and social security number, but none have been used since his disappearance. So what was going on in Jim's life prior to his disappearance? Well, Jim was separated from his wife, and just a few months before his disappearance, he had actually filed for divorce. The couple had two children, and apparently the divorce was looking like it was going to turn rough because they had began fighting over custody of the children. Besides his pending divorce, apparently Jim was having issues with his employment. Now, it's unclear why, but apparently he was possibly facing termination from the church. Jim's estranged wife stated that he had been acting strange and seemed distant and uncommunicative. This lack of communication and distance between the pair is what apparently led to their separation and subsequent divorce. So the investigation into Jim's disappearance carries along without very many leads, or very many good leads. Then in October of 1992, over 10 years later, it seems like police finally get a break in the case. Jim's silver 1974 Volkswagen Scirocco was found. It was abandoned in a heavily wooded area off White Gulch in the Big Belt Mountains, which is northeast of Townsend, where he was last seen. The positioning and the location of the car indicated that it was deliberately hidden. Investigators speculate that whomever left the vehicle at that location had to be familiar with the surrounding area because the vehicle was not visible from the road, the trail, or by air, which is why no one had seen it for the 10 plus years. Jim's wife, or ex-wife at this point, I assume, said that Jim wasn't a very good driver, so she didn't believe that it was Jim that drove the car to that location on his own. She also didn't think that Jim would have walked away on purpose or taken his own life because he adored their children and wouldn't have wanted to hurt them in that way. Now, when they find the car, they do search the area. About a half a mile away from the car, on a ridge overlooking Townsend, Canyon Ferry Lake, and the surrounding area, they found several of Jim's belongings. They located his prayer book, his Old Testament Bible, his cap, his glasses, and his clerical collar, all in that area. Even though they find this car and all of these belongings, Jim's case never again gains much more traction. 7 years after his disappearance, Jim was declared legally dead. So he was actually declared legally dead before they found his car. St. John's Episcopal Church ended up collecting his life insurance policy because about 6 months before he disappeared, he had taken his wife's name off of the insurance policy and enlisted the church as his beneficiary instead. Why he didn't list his children, I'm not sure. Broadwater County Sheriff's Department is the investigating agency in James Anderson's case, if you would happen to have any information. Now, Jim had a friend that he had worked with in White Sulphur Springs about 2 years after Jim disappeared, his friend disappeared. So for our second case, I'm going to tell you about him. John Patrick Kerrigan is case number MP23598 in Namus. He is a Caucasian male with gray hair and blue eyes. He was born on January 20th of 1926 and was 58 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 94 now if he is still alive. He was 6 foot tall and between 185 and 200 pounds. He was last seen wearing a white t-shirt, red shorts, and sneakers. On Friday, July 20th of 1984, Father John Kerrigan went for a jog in the late evening air. After completing his jog, he rewarded himself by stopping into the bakery across from his new home. The bakery was Denault's Bakery, and it sat across the street from Sacred Heart Church, where Father Kerrigan was the new priest. It was just before 11 p.m. when Father Kerrigan walked into the bakery. He briefly chatted with the late-night patrons before walking out, presumably to head home to the rectory right across the street. Father Kerrigan had just been transferred to the Ronan, Nebraska church parish 2 days before this. It was his 13th church since he began his ministry about 30 years before. He was scheduled to hold his first service as the permanent pastor the following day at Sacred Heart. The next day, members of the Ronan Sacred Heart Parish gathered to the 5:30 p.m. Mass. There were more than 100 parishioners awaiting the weekly service to be given by the new priest. Most of the parishioners knew nothing about Father Kerrigan, but were eager to get to know him. 5:30 comes around, and Mass doesn't start. That's no big concern. Maybe the priest got held up. 15 minutes go by, and Father Kerrigan still hasn't arrived. At that point, some of the churchgoers are growing impatient. After a while, most of the parishioners walked out. Some of the others are concerned, so they decided to call the rectory. Maybe Father Kerrigan overslept. When they call the rectory, though, there is no answer. On Sunday, Father Kerrigan doesn't show up for the services that morning either. At that point, the parishioners' concern is growing, and by Sunday evening, the calls of concern begin. By Monday, July 23rd, Father Kerrigan is reported as missing. Within a day or two, a discovery was made. A woman setting up a roadside fruit stand found a pile of bloodied clothes where her stand was to be placed. It seemed like the clothes had been placed right along the side of the Montana Highway 35. It was at a turnout along the east shore of Flathead Lake. The clothes included a shirt, shoes, and a windbreaker. A $100 bill was stuffed into a shirt pocket. Near the abandoned clothes, authorities found a blood-splattered and deformed hanger that may have been used to strangle or hold down the victim. The clothes were not the same that Father Kerrigan was last seen wearing. Eventually, though, crime labs analyzed hair found on the items and determined that the hair matched Father Kerrigan's. Now, it seems like the investigation is on a roll. It would seem like it's only going to get better when about 1 week after Father Kerrigan went missing, they found his Chevy Impala. It was on a hill overlooking Polson, Montana, several miles away from the rectory and just a few miles south of where the bloodstained clothes were found. The car was found at the base of radio towers on Skyline Drive in Polson. The car had been wiped clean of any fingerprints. There was large amounts of blood in the interior and in the trunk, though. Heavy splatters were found in the front seat, on the passenger side door, and spread across the passenger side floorboard. In the trunk, they found a blood-soaked pillow and a bloodied shovel. There are some inconsistencies in the accounts of one thing in this case. Some accounts say that Kerrigan's wallet was found in the clothes on the side of the road and contained about $200. Some accounts say his wallet was located in the trunk of the car with about $1,000 in it. Which version is correct, I'm not sure, but I think the most important part is that the wallet was located with money inside of it. So robbery was not the motive here. The keys to the car were located in a field of weeds about 30 yards away from the vehicle itself. With all of this evidence, it would seem like the investigation would take off. It doesn't. What does take off, though, are the rumors and the fear. It would seem like this reaction was fair, though. Apparently, several frightening events occurred in this area within the week of Father Kerrigan's disappearance. The same week, four inmates escaped in a state-owned vehicle from the minimum security unit of the Montana State Prison at the Swan River Youth Camp. This happened on the Friday that Father Kerrigan was last seen at the bakery. Two of the escaped prisoners kidnapped and raped a woman in Evero, Montana. In a completely unrelated incident on July 22nd, the Sunday, an 18-year-old murdered a 41-year-old woman in her home in Polson. One of the rumors that made its way around was that Father Kerrigan's disappearance may have been the result of a serial killer that targeted priests or holy men. The rumor was that Father Kerrigan's disappearance was connected to the disappearance of his friend, Reverend James Anderson, 2 years earlier. Police have never confirmed a connection between the two cases, however. But rumors are just that, rumors. And Father Kerrigan's case becomes cold pretty quickly. In an attempt to drum up more leads, investigators look into Father Kerrigan's history. It starts off pretty normal. Kerrigan was born and raised in Butte, Montana, and attended St. Joseph's grade school and Center High School. After high school, he went to Seattle to attend St. Edward's Seminary. He was ordained in Butte and began to work in the ministry in the city's St. Patrick's Church in 1954. Investigators did notice something they wanted to look closer into: the fact that Father Kerrigan moved around so much. As I mentioned, Ronan was Kerrigan's 13th parish assignment since his ordination in 1954. After his initial assignment in Butte, he was sent to Hamilton and then back to Butte. Then he was sent to Dillon, Butte again, and then to Browning, Bozeman, Drummond, White Sulphur Springs, Cato, and eventually St. James Parish in Plains from 1980 to 1984. Apparently, in 1965, Father Kerrigan was ministering at three separate churches. There was something else that investigators happened upon: Father Kerrigan's time in New Mexico. He wasn't preaching there either. He was actually at a rehabilitation center for wayward clergy. This place was called the Congregation of the Servants of Parcelet, and it was located in Yemis Springs, New Mexico. Investigators learned that the priests at the Yemis Springs location were there for alcoholism, depression, or sexual delinquency. So why was Father Kerrigan there? That question isn't very easily answered, but I think we'll learn why. I'll tell you about something that investigators did learn about when they looked into Kerrigan's New Mexico getaway. One of the investigators in Kerrigan's case contacted New Mexico authorities and asked about a murder that occurred there about 9 months before Kerrigan arrived. On the night of August 7th, 1982, according to the church officials, Father Ronaldo Rivera answered a phone call from a man who was desperately seeking the last rites of a loved one. 3 days later, Rivera's body was discovered riddled with bullets on a dirt road outside of Santa Fe. Rivera's sacrament bag, wallet, and glasses were never located. The car he was in was located at a rest stop with the keys missing. There are parallels between Father Rivera's murder and the evidence in Father Kerrigan's case. In both cases, it is believed that wire hangers were used in commission of the crime. Robbery was not a motive in either case. Both were members of the Order of the Franciscans. Additionally, both Father Rivera and Father Kerrigan's cars were driven away from the crime scene, then wiped clean of fingerprints and abandoned. Father Kerrigan was 58 and Father Rivera was 57. Father Rivera's body was found near a road a few miles out of town. Father Kerrigan's bloody clothes were found in a similar location. Something a little broader included the fact that both men died or disappeared in the summer. Father Kerrigan's disappearance disappeared shortly before August 1st, and Father Rivera died shortly after August 1st. And both priests drove brown Chevrolets. Now, there was a lot of debate and discussion in New Mexico about whether or not the two cases were connected. Some said they were, some said they weren't. Unsolved Mysteries aired a segment about Father Rivera's murder in 1988. In the segment, the program focused on the similarities between the case in Montana and the Father Rivera murder. After the segment aired, police received several calls in which the caller would direct investigators' attention towards the murder of other priests and ministers. When the publicity of the episode settled, so did the tips, though. In the summer of 1985, it seemed like something was going to break in Father Kerrigan's case. The new sheriff of Lake County at the time announced that they had made progress in solving the case. He didn't name a suspect, but said that the suspect they were looking at was not in Montana. He further explained that he was waiting for more evidence before making an arrest. Then that was it. Nothing else came of that. So let's tie up some loose ends real quick. Father Rivera's case still has not been solved, but there is no evidence to prove a connection to Father Kerrigan's case. There was also no evidence to link those four escaped prisoners to Father Kerrigan's disappearance. Those four subjects were apprehended within a week. Also, the 18-year-old who murdered the woman in her home in Polson was in Ronan the night Father Kerrigan disappeared, but there has never been any evidence connecting him to Kerrigan's disappearance. There has also been no evidence to prove a connection between the disappearance of Reverend James Anderson and Father Kerrigan. So now we're clear. No evidence to connect anything to anything. Okay, so I don't want to focus on this piece too much, but I feel like I have to make you aware. I don't want you to be upset because you find out about it and want to know why I didn't tell you about it. So in April of 2015, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena, Montana, settled a large civil suit alleging that a number of priests had been sexual abusers. The lawsuit said that church leaders reassigned those priests to new parishes, giving them no punishment but a warning to quit molesting. Church hierarchy agreed to a financial settlement and disclosed the identities of 80 former employees, most of them priests and nuns, who had allegedly sexually abused children in West Montana. Kerrigan was among the alleged abusers. Authorities said that they had been aware of the possibility that Kerrigan was involved in child sex abuse from a pretty early point in the investigation. It was also stated that it was not a belief of the investigators that Kerrigan's disappeared at the hands of a victim of his abuse. Now, because Kerrigan's name has been stained as a sexual abuser, and because he no longer has anyone advocating for his case is cold and not going anywhere. If you have any information about John Patrick Kerrigan's disappearance, you can contact the Lake County Sheriff's Office. But before we move on, I just want to let you know that a lot of the information I found on this case is from an article written by Brian D'Ambrosio on flatheadliving.com. I suggest you check it out if you have the time. So before we completely move on, I have to tell you about another case that may or may not be connected to the last two, or at least to Father Kerrigan. This is case number 3730DMMT in the Doe Network and case number MP23615 in Namus. This is the disappearance of Curtis Austin Holman. Curtis is a Caucasian male with blonde hair and blue eyes. He was born on January 21st of 1953 and was 31 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 67 now. He's a pretty big guy, standing at 6'5" and weighing 210 pounds. He wore a size 15 shoe, and his nickname is Kurt. So Kurt's case grabbed the attention of investigators in Kerrigan's case because Kurt disappeared only 2 days after Kerrigan. So Kurt was last seen on July 22nd of 1984 in Missoula. On that evening, he left home to go change his truck's battery. He never came home. Kurt had a girlfriend at the time, and he had called her to make plans to meet up with her at the movie theater in town the following day. He never showed up for their date. So 12 days after he was last seen, Barry Picker found Kurt's 1976 Toyota truck. It was abandoned on an old logging road near Placid Lake. There was a forest map spread out on the front seat, and Kurt's glasses and wallet was also in the truck. The keys to the truck were missing, though. There were no signs of a struggle or anything of that sort at the location, though. As they began to think about why Kurt may have been in the area, no clear-cut answer emerged. The only thing they could think of was that Kurt had mentioned to friends that he wanted to scout different lakes for places to hike at a later time with his brother. Authorities did search the area, which was very rugged, apparently. They did find shoe prints matching Kurt's shoe size, but the shoe tracks were overlaid by grizzly bear tracks. Then, about 20 miles away, at a Girl Scout camp, a man was seen matching Kurt's description. The man apparently appeared disoriented and was rambling about the Vietnam War. The scout leader at the camp asked the man to leave. It has never been confirmed if this man was Kurt or not, but one thing indicating that it wasn't is the fact that Kurt had never served in the military. When Kurt disappeared, he left behind all of his personal belongings. There was no activity on his credit card, social security number, or his bank account that had about $25,000 in it at the time of his disappearance. Now, let's talk about who Kurt was. Kurt grew up in North Dakota and graduated with honors from Jamestown College with a degree in elementary education. He taught 5th and 6th grade in North Dakota and Idaho, and he had also worked for the National Park Services with his wife. At the time of his disappearance, Kurt was a math teacher at Target Range Elementary School in Missoula. At one point in Kurt's life, he had stockpiled food and survival gear and went on a one-year hike in which he traveled as far as Canada and the southwestern U.S. During that hike, he kept in touch with his family on a weekly basis, though. After his divorce in 1982 is when Kurt moved to Montana. Kurt's brother last saw him when Kurt visited North Dakota in the spring of 1984. His brother said that during that visit, Kurt seemed distant and aloof. So police do have a theory based on the evidence they located. They believe that Kurt may have either died by suicide or had a mishap in the wilderness. Let's not forget about those shoe prints overlapped by bear tracks either. To add to that, investigators and searchers did see a female grizzly in the vicinity of the truck. So based on those two things, investigators also theorized that Kurt may have been attacked by a bear. Now, here's where the connection to Kerrigan comes in. Kurt's brother is persistent in his belief that his brother's disappearance is connected to Kerrigan's disappearance. Both men went missing within 2 days of each other in the same area. Also, both of their vehicles were found abandoned in a secluded area, in secluded areas about 40 miles apart. These similarities could be sheer coincidence, though, because law enforcement has no evidence whatsoever to support the theory that the two disappearances are connected. Kurt was eventually declared legally deceased, but his body has never been located, and whatever crime that surrounds his disappearance, if any, has never been solved. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Curtis Austin Holman or have seen someone matching his large, burly description, you can contact the Missoula Police Department. Okay, so I know we were just talking about 1984, but I have to back up about a year to talk about the next case. This next case has a few bizarre twists and turns. It was pretty publicized, so you actually may be aware of it. This is case number 2266 DFMT in the Doe Network, case number MP3898 in Namus, and the NCMEC number for this juvenile is 601812. This is the disappearance of Nylene K. Marshall. Nylene is a Caucasian female with brown hair and blue eyes. She was born on September 18th of 1978 and was only 4 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 41 now. She was only 3 foot 2 inches tall and 29 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was last seen wearing a yellow t-shirt, shorts, and no shoes or socks. Nylene has a small mole above her left eyebrow and dimples on both cheeks. Her upper left baby tooth was chipped at the time of her disappearance. She also had excess hair on her lower back at the time, which she may have grown out of. She is also right-handed. So on June 25th of 1983, 4-year-old Nylene was on a picnic with her family at a campground in the Helena National Forest, which is near Helena, Montana. It was about 4 p.m., and Nylene was playing with some other children at the campground. They had walked ahead of her a bit near the beaver dams on Maupin Creek, where she was sitting. When they turned around to check on Nylene, she was gone. Everyone begins to look for Nylene, but they can't find her. Then the police are called. They search the campground area extensively, and they can't find her either. They do discover that an unknown male wearing a purple jogging suit was seen nearby just before Nylene disappeared. I believe two children that Nylene was playing with actually reported this. This man apparently spoke to Nylene and told her to follow the shadow. This man was never identified, though, and they are still not sure if he had anything to do with her disappearance. The search continued and pulled in volunteers and the FBI. They even searched abandoned mine shafts in the area, but this resulted in no Nylene and no clues. The searches lasted for 9 days, and then they were called off. Police do their routine work, and they question Nylene's family. Pretty early on, Nylene's stepfather was seen as a person of interest, but the reasons why he was seen as a person of interest are unknown, or at least I couldn't find it. Now, Nylene's mother apparently died in 1995. From what I have read, Nancy, Nylene's mom, was transferred to Mexico for work. While she was staying in a motel, she was raped and strangled. Police in Mexico ruled the death a suicide, even though evidence at the scene indicated that it was a homicide. Nancy's death has never been appropriately investigated or solved. So let's go back to when Nancy was actually still alive and looking for answers in her daughter's disappearance. Nylene's case becomes pretty cold until it seems like police are going to catch a break in 1985. On November 27th of 1985, after Nylene had been missing for about 2 years, an anonymous phone call was placed to the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. This first of many calls was from a man claiming to have abducted Nylene. The police traced the phone calls to various phone booths in Edgerton, Wisconsin, but when the phone booths were identified, the call stopped. 2 months later, in early 1986, a typewritten letter was sent to law enforcement in Wisconsin from an anonymous man claiming he had picked up a girl named Kay. This letter included details of Nylene's disappearance that had never been released to the public. A detective would say that the author of this letter was privy to things that a normal person would not have access to. The writer of the letter explained that he had a good investment income and worked from home, where he homeschooled Kay. He also claimed to travel frequently with her throughout the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. He claimed that though he knew her family missed her, he loved her and could not return her. The letter was postmarked from Madison, Wisconsin. Around the same time, an anonymous caller claiming to be the writer of the letter placed several phone calls to Child Find of America, a national missing children's nonprofit in New York. The phone calls made to Child Find were traced to several phone booths, including one located near a pharmacy in Edgerton, Wisconsin. Law enforcement disclosed that information relayed from the caller and in the letter suggested... I'm sorry, let me try that again. Law enforcement disclosed that information relayed from the caller and in the letters suggested that Nylene was a victim of sexual abuse. Okay. When Nylene's case was aired on Unsolved Mysteries, they actually provided excerpts of the letter. There are three excerpts, and I'll read them to you because I know that you're curious. Excerpt 1. I didn't know their person to try to get information from her. All I could tell them was that she was okay. I hope Child Find can get the following back to her family. I picked Kay up on the road in Elkhorn Park area between Helena and Boulder. She was crying and frightened, and as I held her, she was shaking, and I decided that I would keep her and love her. I took her home with me. I have a nice investment income, and I can work at home, so I care for her myself all the time. I teach her at home, and she likes to go with me when I travel. Her hair is short and curly now, and she has really grown. She is about 45 inches and around 50 pounds. She has all four of her permanent upper and two of her lower incisors at this time. She takes a bath and brushes her teeth every day. She eats well. Her favorite meal is pizza and cherry. The excerpt is cut off after cherry, so I'm not sure what she likes that's cherry flavored. Excerpt number 2. She would gladly recount to you trips to San Francisco, New York, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Nashville, Chicago, Puerto Rico, and Canada. We were even in Britain for a month last year, and she loved it. Nobody questions passports. The last one is probably the most disgusting. It starts in the middle of a sentence, it seems. So just try and understand it if you can. It is, or where it comes from, only that I get it from the bathroom every morning. It is actually a spoonful of my semen. It doesn't affect her physically. I have never molested her in any other way. She is a sweet little girl, and it is because of how much I have grown to love her that I realize how much her family must miss her. She has adjusted and seems happy. She trusts me and isn't afraid. We play a lot, and she laughs when we clown around. She smiles and acts coy when I tease her. She giggles when we snuggle and hugs me sometimes for no apparent reason. I love her, and I have her. I just can't let her go. So, sometime after the letters and the phone calls were received, a witness claimed to have seen a girl resembling Nylene at a restaurant in Janesville, Wisconsin. So after the letters were received, an unnamed person claimed to have murdered Nylene and disposed of her body in a mine shaft near Helena. The mine shaft, which had been sealed since, was searched, but nothing was located. Nylene still has not been located. The person who made the phone calls and wrote the letter has still never been identified. Although the author and the caller knew more information than he should have, investigators are still unsure if he actually had anything to do with Nylene's disappearance. It is still a possibility that Nylene simply wandered off on that day in 1983 and succumbed to the elements of the wilderness. If you do know anything about Nylene K. Marshall's whereabouts or anything about her disappearance, I urge you to contact Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. Nylene would only be 41 now, so there is a strong possibility that she may still be alive. Okay, so let's move on to the next disappearance for this week. This is case number 1071DFMT in the Doe Network and case number MP8299 in Namus. This is the disappearance of Patricia Bernadette Meehan. Patty is a Caucasian female with blonde hair and gray or green eyes. She was born on November 1st of 1951 and was 37 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 68 now. She stands at 5'3" and weighed between 100 and 117 pounds. She was last seen wearing a brown coat, jeans, and high top sneakers. She was also carrying a leather purse. Patty has fair freckled complexion and looks a lot younger than she actually is. She speaks with a mild Eastern accent and she's very quiet. She almost speaks in a whisper. I'm sorry. So there is a Wikipedia page on Patty's disappearance and it provides some pretty good backstory. So some of the story is going to come from there. Patty was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. When it came time for college, Patty decided to head to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. At college, she studied early childhood development with the hopes of starting a career in daycare. But in 1985, Patty decided to change her life course and move to Bozeman, Montana. There, she worked as a ranch hand because she loved animals, and this is how she explained her career change. To support herself, Patty worked odd jobs in addition to her ranch work. One of the last people to see Patty before her disappearance was actually her landlord. He noted that Patty's demeanor was out of the ordinary. He said she seemed more hyper than usual. On April 19th of 1989, Patty spoke to her father in Pittsburgh. She told him that she was under a lot of stress and wanted to go home. Apparently, Patty had been so distressed that she had made an appointment to see a psychologist on the morning of April 21st. So her father told her that she could come back home, but he wanted her to speak to the psychologist first. It's about 8:15 p.m. on April 20th of 1989. A woman by the name of Peggy Bueller and her father are traveling west on Montana Highway 200 near Circle, Montana. Peggy sees a vehicle headed east, driving on the wrong side of the road. Peggy swerves onto the shoulder of the highway, barely missing a head-on collision with the car. The car behind Peggy wasn't so lucky. The car that was traveling in the wrong direction collided head-on with the vehicle behind Peggy's, the driver of which just happened to be an off-duty dispatcher by the name of Carol Heights. Carol was luckily able to emerge from the wreckage unharmed. The person in the other vehicle also emerged from the wreckage, but what happened next was much more bizarre than the accident itself. The blonde woman emerged from the mangled vehicle and walked up to Carol and stood there and seemed to stare straight through her. The woman never spoke, just stared. Peggy, who was still pulled over on the shoulder, watched as this blonde woman climbed over a nearby fence. Once she reached the other side, she just stood there and stared at the accident scene without moving. She was standing, staring at the scene, as if she was a spectator and not involved in the crash at all. The woman stood silently and still for several minutes before all of a sudden walking away into an empty field. Now, this is 1989, so Peggy had to drive into town to a phone to contact law enforcement. Carol stayed at the scene with Carol's father. I'm sorry. Carol stayed at the scene with Peggy's father. By the time police arrived at the scene, the woman from the other vehicle was nowhere to be found. Police ran the license plate of the vehicle and discovered that the registered owner of the vehicle was Patricia Bernadette Meehan. She was identified as the woman they had seen walking away from the accident. This identification occurred within 30 minutes. Police begin to investigate the accident, and they discover a trail of tennis shoe tracks beginning in a desolate field approximately 3/4 of a mile away from the scene of the crash. Based on the size of the shoe impression, investigators believe they were Patty's tracks. Investigators followed the tracks until about 3 a.m. on the morning of April 21st. The tracks ended when the impressions were lost in the terrain. The search was suspended until later in the morning. Patty's family arrived in Montana pretty quickly after Patty disappeared. They distributed over 2,000 missing persons flyers throughout the area. Local volunteers searched the surrounding mountains and terrain near the site of the crash by horse and ATV, and the Meehan family also employed a helicopter to search overhead. All of this unfortunately resulted in no indication of where Patty could be. Abandoned coal mines in the area were also searched, but this too turned up nothing. The site of the accident near Circle was nearly 400 miles from where Patty was living in Bozeman. No one, including Patty's family, could explain why Patty was in this area so far from home. Police theorized that Patty had fled the scene by hitchhiking or stowing away in a hay truck that had been parked only a half a mile away from the accident site. No sightings were reported to support these theories, though. According to Patty's mom, Patty had been experiencing depression at the time, and she also mentioned that Patty was planning to meet with the psychologist the morning after the accident. Early on in the case, it was suspected that Patty may have been suffering from amnesia, but it is unclear if they think the amnesia was the result of the accident or if it occurred before. Now, after Patty is reported missing, sightings were reported all over the U.S. There have been over 5,000 reported sightings of a woman resembling Patty since her 1989 disappearance. I'll tell you about some of those reported sightings now. On May 4th of 1989, a police officer in Laverne, Minnesota, claimed to have seen Patty sitting inside a Hardee's restaurant. She had been drinking water alone in a booth for over 5 hours until the restaurant's closing time, then walked to a nearby 24-hour diner. When the officer questioned her, she refused to give her name and claimed to be from Colorado and then from Israel. The following day, on May 5th, two other sightings of Patty were reported, one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where a waitress claimed Patty had sat inside a truck stop diner drinking coffee from 12 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. The same day, a waitress at another diner in Morado, South Dakota, reported seeing Patty between 10 and 11 p.m. in the company of a man who appeared to be in his 30s. On May 19th of 1989, shortly after her disappearance, a waitress at a restaurant near Patty's home in Bozeman reported seeing her there. According to the waitress, Patty ordered and ate breakfast in a hurried manner and mentioned that she had to go shopping at 9 a.m. Another waitress working the same morning also saw Patty at the restaurant and reported that she appeared to be disoriented and talking to herself. The same week, another reported sighting occurred at a horse auction in Billings, Montana. Over 2 weeks later, on May 30th, a woman resembling Patty was seen by a passing truck driver on Interstate 90 in rural Washington. The driver offered her a ride, which she declined, and the woman told another passing female motorist that her car had broken down and that she was going to find a phone. Another alleged sighting of Patty was reported the following week in Tacoma, Washington, by a Port of Tacoma employee who claimed to have seen her at a truck stop on Interstate 5 asking strangers for directions to Aberdeen. By June of 1989, over 25 sightings of Patty had been reported, three of which were confirmed by the police. Other reported sightings of Patty were received by law enforcement throughout the Pacific Northwest, many at truck stops between Montana and Seattle. Law enforcement believed Patty may have been in Washington State during this time, and she had an ex-boyfriend in Spokane, and her sister lived in Seattle, so that might explain why she was drawn to that area. On August 30th of 1990, a transient woman was arrested by police in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, for littering. The woman bore a resemblance to Patty, and the arresting officer initially believed that it was her. On September 1st, the woman appeared in a Kootenai County court where she claimed before the judge to be a missionary traveling between Montana and Washington. Although the reported sighting made news in the Seattle Times, it was confirmed through fingerprint analysis, that the woman was in fact not Patty. Speaking to the media and law enforcement, Patty's former boyfriend, Kurt Fletcher of Spokane, Washington, noted there was a strong resemblance and that the woman had a similar voice to Patty's. So Patty's case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries on November 1st of 1989. This was Patty's 38th birthday, and she was featured on Season 3, Episode 35 of the series. Based on photographs and videotapes, Patty's parents verified sightings from Montana, Washington, South Dakota, and Minnesota in the months after her disappearance. It is believed that Patty frequented truck stops and all-night diners in her travels. At this point in time, Patty is 68 and could very well still be alive. She just may have no idea who she really is. If you think you have seen Patricia Bernadette Meehan, you can contact local law enforcement or you can contact the Macomb County Sheriff's Office. This next case is really a tale of the cautions of internet dating. This is case number MP23385 in Namus, the disappearance of Lucille Helen Lewis. Lucille is a Caucasian female with brown hair and blue eyes. She was born on September 25th of 1952 and was 53 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 67 now. She stood between 5'2" and 5'5" and weighed about 150 pounds. Her nickname is Louie, and she wears glasses. Lucille had been married for 20 years, but the marriage ended around 2005. The divorce seemed amicable, and Lucille and her ex-husband actually remained friends. It was time for Lucille to start dating again, and in the age of increasing internet technology via 2005, online dating became an easy option for Lucille. In October of 2005, Lucille began chatting on the internet with a man by the name of Earl Dean Stipe. They apparently got along really well, and only a few short weeks into courting, Lucille agreed to move from her home in Newburg, Oregon, to be with Stipe in St. Ignatius, Montana. Stipe told Lucille that he was a retired federal marshal who owned a ranch, so Lucille was pretty excited to start this new chapter in her life with Stipe. Lucille packed her belongings and left for Montana in November of 2005. After Lucille moved to Montana, none of her friends or family in Oregon heard from her. She was close with her family, and she and her ex-husband were on friendly terms, so for her not to contact them seemed unusual. Lucille's sister repeatedly tried to reach Lucille on her cell phone, but no one ever answered. By February of 2006, Lucille's sister had had enough and contacted Stipe and asked about her sister. Stipe told her that Lucille wanted to return to Oregon, and he last saw her when he dropped her off at the Missoula International Airport in Missoula, Montana on January 31st. Because Lucille never arrived in Oregon, Lucille's sister said enough is enough and filed a missing persons report with Montana police. When police received Lucille's missing persons report, they head over to Stipe's to question him about Lucille's disappearance. While at the residence, police find over a dozen firearms inside. This would be no big deal in Montana if Stipe wasn't a convicted felon on probation. A fact I'm sure he forgot to mention to Lucille before she moved to be with him. The fact that he was a felon on probation meant that he couldn't own firearms, so he was arrested. Turns out, Stipe was never a federal marshal, and he didn't own a ranch. In fact, he lived in a trailer with his adult son, his son's girlfriend, and two children. They also found out through investigation that Stipe had forged Lucille's name on checks and had pawned some of her jewelry and other belongings. In November of 2007, Stipe was sentenced to 18 months on the charges of a felon in possession of a firearm. Now, the original felony conviction was for forgery and not a violent crime, but Stipe's own son described his father as violent and abusive. So there's that. I was actually looking to find out whatever happened to Earl Stipe, and I believe I found his obituary. If it is the same Earl Dean Stipe, he died on April 6th of 2019 at the age of 66. It says he died at his home in Big Fork, Montana, and he is survived by two sons. Stipe, of course, is or was the main person of interest in Lucille's disappearance. If Stipe is the only one with answers, I'm afraid the questions are going to remain unanswered. But if you know anything about Lucille Helen Lewis's disappearance or her whereabouts, please contact the Lake County Sheriff's Office. Okay, I have one final case for you this week. It's really kind of sad, and I hate leaving out on sad notes. So, after I tell you about this case, I do have a scene again just to end on a good note. This is case number MP6303 in Namus, and it is a juvenile case, so the NCMEC number is 111-3537. This is the disappearance of Wyatt Cole Littlewhite. Wyatt is a Native American male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on October 24th of 2008, and he was almost 2 months old at the time of his disappearance. He would be 11 now. He was 19 inches long and a healthy 15 pounds. Wyatt is a registered member of the Crow Indian tribe. It's December 23rd of 2008, right before Christmas. Wyatt and his parents, Juliet Tonita Littlewhite and Teddy Littlewhite travel to Crow Agency, Montana to drop Wyatt's half-brother off at his mom's house. Some accounts say that after they left Crow Agency, they were on their way to a funeral near Wyola. They were never seen again after leaving Crow Agency. No one even realized that they were missing until early January of 2009. Juliet's grandmother died, and when Juliet didn't attend the funeral, they realized that the family hadn't been seen since before Christmas. They are reported as missing soon after this point, and the searches begin. On January 5th, searchers found the family's blue and white 1996 Chevrolet pickup truck 6 miles up Graveville Road between Highway 91 and Fort Smith, Montana. It was parked about 30 feet off the road in an open prairie area where Teddy had previously gone hunting. The truck had about half a tank of gas and was in operable condition. The search of the area revealed no signs of the Littlewhites, though. The weather during this period of time was bitterly cold and the snow was very deep. The investigation continued with little progress for a while. Then, in May, a rancher came across two bodies in a field a few miles south of Fort Smith. The remains were scattered over a wide area on rugged terrain about 2 or 3 miles from where the Littlewhite's truck had been found. When the truck was found, authorities did search that area, but at the time, the snow hindered the search efforts, and it is believed that they simply missed finding the bodies. The bodies that were found were determined to be that of Juliet and Teddy. Adult and infant-sized clothing items were found at the scene of the bodies, and there was no signs of little Wyatt. The manner of death is listed as undetermined, but the medical examiner and investigators say that the cause of death is consistent with exposure. Foul play is not suspected in the case of the Littlewhites. They have never been able to locate Wyatt, but investigators do believe that there is a possibility that Wyatt was wholly consumed by animals. This case really does confuse me a little bit. I don't understand why they ended up in that field outside of the vehicle that by all accounts was in running condition. I guess they could have accidentally left the roadway and got stuck, but I've seen no accounts of the truck being stuck in that field or an accident occurring. And the location of the truck, it being somewhere that Teddy was familiar with, seems odd to me. I still don't understand why they all exited the truck, including almost two-month-old Wyatt, whose tiny body was not equipped to deal with such cold weather. I'm curious to see if any of you have a theory about this. I feel like I'm missing something that should be really clear to me. So if you have a theory or you understand what's going on in this case, please comment on the post for this episode and let me know. On Facebook, I'm sorry. Or you can send me a message or an email. I wouldn't mind that either. If you would happen to know anything about the case of the Little Lights or Wyatt Cole Little Lights' whereabouts, you can contact the Bighorn County Sheriff's Department or the Bureau of Indian Affairs Crow Agency office. As promised, I have a scene again for you. So this scene again is not actually a missing person from Montana. This person wasn't even discovered in Montana. The reason I'm going to tell you about this scene again is because one of the cases I covered actually resulted in this person being found. So let's talk about it. 5-year-old Monica Bonilla was the daughter of Guillermo Ruiz Bonilla and Rosemary Levi. According to Rosemary, Guillermo's behavior began to change radically after the murder of John Lennon in 1980. One day, he woke up and told her that John had reincarnated in him. After that, he took it upon himself to do everything possible to look like him. He let his beard grow out, he let his hair grow long, and he purchased clothing that John would wear. According to Rosemary, Guillermo's changes made things worse for their marriage because they had nothing left in common. On September 22nd of 1982, Rosemary came home from work and found their Burbank, California home completely empty. He took all of their furniture and possessions, even the light fixtures, and he also damaged items related to their wedding. Finally, he took their daughter, Monica. The next day, one of his relatives contacted Rosemary and told her that she would never see Monica again. 2 months later, a judge awarded Rosemary custody of Monica. However, with her daughter still missing, the judgment was virtually meaningless. Rosemary prayed and never lost hope that she would see Monica again. Since the kidnapping, she had remarried and had a son, Dorian. She spent over $20,000 searching for Monica. However, there were no leads in the case for over 8 years. On November 21st of 1990, Unsolved Mysteries featured a segment about 4-year-old Nyleen Marshall. As a result of the broadcast, hundreds of viewers called the telecenter. One of the callers was a school official in Vancouver, British Columbia. Accounts differ here. Another account says that it was a viewer that called believing that Nyleen was one of his classmates in Bellingham, Washington. I'll go with the school official account because there's just more information about that being the case. So the school official that called believed that one of her students was Nyleen Marshall, living in Point Roberts, Washington, under an assumed name. Every day, a 12-year-old girl named Mary Ann Kelly was driven to school in Vancouver, British Columbia by her father, Robert Kelly. Most people who came in contact with him thought he was suspicious. They noted he was very difficult to contact and had no telephone number where he could be reached. When asked for an address, he would say that he was between addresses. School officials were also concerned because of what Robert would do when he dropped Mary off at the school. According to her teacher, when she would come into the classroom, he would watch Mary Ann through the window to make sure she was there. His behavior frightened the teacher. After the broadcast, her teacher began to suspect that she was Nyleen. School officials contacted the FBI, who put Marianne and Robert under surveillance. The agents also reviewed her school records and discovered that they were false. The agents wanted to be careful not to spook Robert, whom they believed was Nyleen's kidnapper. In December of 1990, FBI agents arrived at the home, at the Kelly home, with a search warrant. The house was searched extensively. Eventually, in a closet, they found a box labeled "Bathroom Articles." In it was a photo album with pictures of Guillermo, Monica, and Rosemary, along with Monica's birth certificate. It became clear to investigators that Marianne Kelly was not Nyleen, but she was instead Monica Bonilla. Guillermo was arrested and agreed to surrender himself to Los Angeles authorities to face charges of parental kidnapping. Monica told authorities that she was treated well by her father. However, she also said that she had been told that her mother was dead. On December 22nd of 1990, Monica was finally reunited with Rosemary and met Dorian, her half-brother, for the very first time, who she hadn't even known about. So most of that story came from unsolvedmysteries.fandom.com, which I visit often in researching these cases. Monica's case wasn't actually originally featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Unsolved Mysteries, though, did help lead to her discovery, and there was an update in regards to Monica's case featured on the February 6th, 1991 episode. I haven't been able to find a photo of 5-year-old Monica to see how closely she resembles Nyleen, but I feel like they have to be similar if they thought that she was actually Nyleen. So that is it for this week, my people. Montana was pretty much exactly what I expected it to be. As always, I hope that you enjoyed my telling of these cases, and I can't wait to see where we end up next week. As always, if you like this episode, or hell, this whole podcast, tell your friends, share it on social media. Just send people my way. I will always appreciate new listeners. If you haven't done so already, please go like, follow, favorite, rate, and or review on whatever platform you listen on, if any of those are an option. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or Stitcher, please do me the favor of giving this podcast those 5 stars. You will have to leave a review, but you can say whatever you please in the review. Sadly enough, it matters less than the stars. If you aren't already, go like and follow the Facebook page. You can find it at NTBSA Podcast. You can send me messages there with case suggestions. And just a quick heads up, at some point, the Louisiana episode is coming up, and I know a lot of you are waiting on that episode. So send me your case suggestions starting now. I haven't decided how far ahead that episode is going to be, but I really want to have my cases lined up before that point. If you don't have a Facebook, no worries. You can email me any case suggestions to nevertobeseenagainpodcast@gmail.com. You don't have to do the research. I'll do all that. You can just send me a name. If you have a personal connection to the case that you suggest, I would love to hear about it. But if you don't want any of that information to be revealed to your fellow listeners, it can be our little secret. Thank you for your continued support and tuning in every week to hear me tell you about these cases. I really do enjoy doing this, and I'm hoping by the time we get through all 50 states, I'll have a multitude of listeners who are ready for a second trip around. I hope you tune in again next week when I will tell you more about those never to be seen again.